We've all been on a journey, but after 4 years of fighting it, we lost. Brexit has happened. Of course, it's not really over. Brexit will mean years of endless and difficult negotiations with the EU and the rest of the world. But for now, Britain has left the club. And so it seems like a good time to look back at it all and ask the questions after this long old battle. What did we get right and what did we get wrong? Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Zoe Williams, and my co-host, Luke Cooper. On this episode, we're calling the Big Brexit Review. We're joined by Another Europe podcast regular, Nick Dearden from Global Justice Now. Nick, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
Do you remember this bit, guys?
Ladies and gentlemen, dare to dream that the dawn is breaking on an independent, united kingdom.
Well, you've put us on a right downer.
So it's June 2016. Mm-hmm. What were we thinking then? Because I remember looking back and Another Europe had this, hey, we've been defeated. Nick wrote a very nice statement that you can still read on the website. You know, it's better to light a candle than curse the darkness. Brexit is going to happen. It's over. Let's try and make it as good as possible. Flash forward to 2020, where Brexit really has happened. It's all over. Let's try to make it as good as possible. And sometime in that intervening period, Brexit hit the rocks.
I mean, it was very difficult to comprehend because we're not used to binaries like that in an election. It takes a while to wrap your head around what happened. And I suppose my regret about that phase immediately afterwards was that I didn't give myself time to wrap my head around it before I started talking again. So immediately I remember going to an event in Parliament a couple of weeks later and Keir Starmer actually saying we've got to accept the fact that Brexit has happened and fight for the best possible Brexit, and thinking, I don't want to do that yet. I don't think that's where we're going to end up, and being completely unable to conceive what the alternative to acceptance was, but still kind of, you know, being in the fray. I think I wish I'd taken 6 months out of the whole conversation.
But the problem was, I suppose, that we couldn't, because people were looking for a path forward. People were looking for some hope and some optimism. And I definitely remember, I mean, I remember the morning because I was travelling back from Austria that day. So I was on like an 18-hour train journey, obsessively looking at the news and trying to gather my thoughts and looking for that from other people. I remember that morning there was a piece in The Guardian by John McDonnell, which I thought was a really very, very strong piece, saying we didn't need to be here, it's the Tories that threw us into this desperate situation. And that for me provided an anchor. Because we were so unanchored that morning. And indeed, of course, that was part of the point, wasn't it? I mean, for Farage and for those that have been pushing Brexit for a very long time, I mean, part of the point of all of this was to remove the anchor for people like us, for the left, for progressives in general. I mean, part of the idea was to throw everything up in the air.
Yeah.
Because they hoped they would be able to make some real strides forward. And they have. I mean, they have been proved absolutely, absolutely right in that.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're right that we didn't have any time to think or assess.
Yeah, there was no time to reflect. There was no sense of what it actually meant because the offer was so baggy and loose. There was no... You didn't really know what you were reacting to. All you knew was that you'd lost something major, but there was no sense of what you'd actually lost. You know, you couldn't... I didn't even... You know, I remember somebody explaining to me what a customs union, how a customs union differed from a single market. After the referendum.
We've learned so much.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We've learned a huge amount about how the EU works.
We know how it works now.
Well, yeah, just about. The other thing, I think, that took up a lot of those of time in the immediate aftermath was there was an immediate spate of racist attacks.
Mm.
And I remember there was that horrible attack on a Muslim woman who's pregnant in Milton Keynes.
Police arrested the racist attacker whose assault on a pregnant woman led to the death of her unborn child. Thames Valley Police said the arrest was made on Wednesday.
There was loads of anecdotal stuff just about abuse in the street, abuse in shops.
Yeah.
And that it seemed very, very important to react to that.
There was also points of hope. It wasn't just racism and negativity, you know, that huge demonstration that happens very shortly after the vote. Extremely, we've grown totally used to it now, but extremely weird to go on such a demonstration in London that after Britain has decided to leave the EU, there were like hundreds of thousands of people in England, like waving EU flags and saying how much they love the EU.
Around 50,000 people marched to the Houses of Parliament to voice their dissatisfaction with the country's decision to withdraw from the 28-member union.
I remember the Stop Trump rally and Michael saying how much, you know, these are all our people. They are all the same people. They're exactly the people who oppose Brexit. But somehow stopping Trump managed to unite the left in a completely uncontroversial and in a completely obvious way, in a way that anti-Brexit campaigning never did.
I think it was extremely hard to do. And I think it was extremely hard to do because some of those who'd actually supported Brexit on the left, even on the far left, were so entrenched in their position. And I'm not arguing that we weren't entrenched in our position. I mean, everybody was. But the people that had voted for Brexit and campaigned for Brexit were so determined to suggest that it wasn't racist, there was nothing racist about it, that they literally, I mean, I remember some of the leaders of the Lexit campaign coming out and saying it was just nonsense, like it hadn't increased racism.
Oh, yeah. No,
and so I think it was really hard. It was really hard to make that alliance. And it was hard because, for me, I mean, as somebody who, you know, I said last time we were talking, you know, I've never been in love with the EU institutions. So it was a hard decision to fight against Brexit in such an outward way. But for me, it was so clearly linked to a far right agenda. The idea there were other people on the left who couldn't see that was just too much, really. It was just too much that there were people who'd helped facilitate this victory of racism without apparently any kind of reflection that they might have done something problematic.
But I suppose that sort of explains how we got into this absurd position further on through the journey, where the left, the kind of Corbyn left, appropriated the left space as being pro-Brexit. And everybody who was anti-Brexit de facto became a centrist, which was insane to me. It was completely absurd.
Let's fast forward to 2017 and Theresa May speaking at Downing Street.
At this moment of enormous national significance, there should be unity here in Westminster. But instead, there is division. The country is coming together, but Westminster is not. Our opponents believe, because the government's majority is so small, that our resolve will weaken and that they can force us to change course. If we do not hold a general election now, their political game playing will continue, and the negotiations with the European Union will reach their most difficult stage in the run-up to the next scheduled election. Division in Westminster will risk our ability to make a success of Brexit, and it will cause damaging uncertainty and instability to the country. So we need a general election, and we need one now.
Right, the reason I wanted to play that, because I was doing a bit of research earlier, comparing Theresa May's line in 2017 and Boris Johnson's line in 2019, and I stumbled across this. And it really struck me that Theresa May anticipated what was going to happen 2 years later, that she wouldn't be able to get her deal through Parliament. And she actually tried to fight the 2017 general election on a very similar platform, at least in terms of Brexit, to the one that Johnson would use 2 years later. Because basically saying, Westminster won't let me get this through. Mm-hmm. We need to get a strong and stable government. Give me the mandate to get it through. So Johnson emerges as this chancer, to be honest. He was just lucky because he could have been in exactly the same position as her if he'd won the Tory leadership in 2016.
Well, that is also the attrition line, isn't it? It's like when she was saying get Brexit done, it hadn't been boring everybody to death for three years. So she didn't have that on her side. Corbyn obviously was a lot more popular because he hadn't tergiversated in the same way. My big regret about this phase is that I made a fundamental error. I thought because she was so shit that there was more scope, there was more space to play than there actually was. And there was this really good David Runciman article at the weekend, I don't know if you saw it, where he said Parliament is still Parliament. A referendum, binding or not, might seem like an aberration and something that doesn't really fit into our democracy, but it's executed by Parliament. It is still... So our democracy is working in exactly the same way as it always has. And people who thought they could get a second referendum were dreaming, because if you can't get the unity to get Brexit through, then you can't get the unity to get a referendum through, a second referendum. If you can't get that unity, then and you're deadlocked, the parliamentary answer to deadlock is literally never to kind of keep on trying until it happens. The parliamentary answer to deadlock is an election.
Completely.
So we weren't always kidding ourselves when we thought, and people who say now, oh, nobody should have given Johnson the election that he wanted, they should have held out, you know, there are only 11 votes between that Carl Wilson amendment and this amendment, blah, blah, blah. They're dreaming as well. Parliament was always...
Completely.
Always deadlocked. And the fact that Theresa May was so patently useless kind of gave us a sense of security and a sense of anything might happen, which just didn't exist.
Well, I think that that's the comparison between 2017 and 2019 in a way. Like, everyone remembers the dementia tax.
4 days ago, your manifesto rejected a cap on social care costs. Today, you announced a cap. That sounds pretty half-baked.
Nothing has changed.
Everyone remembers the May bot, how wooden she was, terrible campaigner.
That doesn't look so strong and stable, Prime Minister, does it? It looks rather like panic.
But there was also, although the message around Brexit was surprisingly similar, not get Brexit done, strong and stable, but the content was actually the same, the message around austerity changed a lot in 2019. So, you know, Theresa May's message on austerity was very Cameron-like. You know, she said stuff like the magic money tree came out a few times.
There isn't a magic money tree that we can shake that suddenly provides for everything that people want.
And Corbyn was really able to occupy that anti-austerity space and keep a lot of those Labour leavers in the tent. So the result we get in 2019 is the result we expected to get in 2017.
It was definitely the result we expected. I mean, I remember being terrified, and terrified by rhetoric she was using, like on the clip there that Boris Johnson has used since. But the thing we didn't realise, I think the thing I didn't realise about Theresa May, is how personally ambivalent she actually was about Brexit. And for her, it was about getting it done. Whatever the institutional arrangement was, she had other things she wanted to concentrate on. The problem for her was that she had a whole wing that rapidly became the majority in the Tory party that had been empowered by the result, and far from wanting any kind of compromise, they wanted the hardest Brexit possible, and they didn't trust May, and they didn't think she really believed what she was saying, and so she was kind of stuck in the middle, winding those of us who didn't want Brexit up by this kind of hyped up nationalist rhetoric, but on her own benches it wasn't working because they didn't believe in her either. So they very soon realised they picked the wrong candidate. And I suppose the difference with Johnson getting the nomination then is he would have spoken more authentically to some of the hard right in his own party who trusted him. I mean, they would have trusted him implicitly in a way that they didn't trust Theresa May. But at the time, it seemed like, you know, she was going to ram through Brexit, whatever the consequences.
But then sometimes I wonder about that ERG wing, how much of it was actually their desire for a hard Brexit. If you look at the rhetoric they used before the referendum, you know, of course we can have a single market, of course we can have this, it will be kind of basically the same except better. I wonder how much really was about what they wanted vis-a-vis the EU, and what was about what they wanted for themselves and their own reputations and their own place in the party. So there was no... There's no way, you know, Boris Johnson, they might have trusted him, but they were looking to kind of distinguish themselves and go out in this kind of Marc Francois heroism where, you know, nothing is ever good enough for him, nothing is ever good enough for his grandfather who fought in the whatever, nothing, you know... they were in a kind of war between each other to see who could be the most patriotic, where patriotism was defined as lack of cooperation. So how on earth any leader negotiates with those people without a strong majority? I've got no clue. Yeah.
But there's something real in what they're saying as well, isn't there? In that if Brexit is, as I've argued for a long time, for many of those in the leadership of Vote Leave, an attempt at shock doctrine, an attempt to fundamentally rewire and restructure the British economy, you actually can't do that in the single market or the customs union.
Yeah, yeah.
So there was a reality to what they were saying, which is, for us, this project is about fundamentally changing this country. And in order to fundamentally change this country, we need to be well outside of EU standards, protections and regulations. And we actually require this shock to our political system in order to be able to achieve that. And I think interestingly, although Johnson has been able to sum up some of the rhetoric that has kept people on side up till now, he is going to be faced with exactly the same problem over the next year.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And what we've seen this week is proof of that, that, you know, does he actually want this EU deal on the only terms he'll be able to get it, with some kind of level playing field? Or is he actually prepared to send society and the economy into a very, very serious fundamental shock in order to achieve that break that many of the Brexiteers want?
November 2018, so just over a year ago, this is where we have like mass resignations over the Theresa May deal when it finally comes out.
Theresa May claims she is not for turning. At a news conference inside Number 10 this afternoon, she defended her Brexit plan to the very hilt.
I thought it would be fun if we took a clip from what we were saying on the podcast.
Eloise, what's your dream scenario?
Dream scenario is that we put this deal to the vote, it's voted down. And then, you know, I quite like Luke's dream scenario, this idea that Labour would actually campaign in a general election scenario to stay in. It wouldn't be enough for them to just campaign to get a referendum. They would have to really be on the front foot of wanting to stay in. And I just don't see that happening. So I think we have to go through the motions and take all options off the table, take no deal off the table, take EEA off the table, and then build this very strong majority in Parliament to put the government's deal back to the people. And I also think, you know, that would also be better for the Labour Party, frankly, because there's no reason why Labour needs to be left holding the Brexit baby.
That went well.
But actually, I mean, having just said that, I wish I'd taken heed more of the parliamentary reality and the reality of the parliamentary system. Really, I'm not just saying this to be partisan, even though I know you think I am. Keir's approach was the only intelligent approach, because the only way that Parliament was going to duck round Brexit was with that Kyle Wilson amendment. And he always said that. He always said, we're not going to get a second referendum for free, but nor is anybody going to get a deal for free. The only way we're going to do this is if it comes hand in hand with, you know, and the Kyle Wilson Amendment, for anybody who's fortunate enough to have forgotten, was, we will vote through your deal so long as there's a referendum on it. And that was the only way it was going to... Lisa Nandy's idea, which was, I will vote through the kind of Brexit that I think is acceptable, was never going to work, because she was never, you know, that those kind of odds and sods Labour quasi-Lexit MPs were never as numerous or as vocal as the incredibly hardline Tories. So that was never going to happen. And in terms of, you know, if we take Rebecca Long-Bailey as the Corbyn position, which is never decide, never decide, never decide, piss everybody off, that didn't work. Dandy's line wouldn't have worked. The only one who could possibly have worked would have been Keir's line, but that didn't work either.
Yeah, and there's a point in the podcast that I cruelly picked out when we were talking to Lloyd Russell Moyle, where he says, oh, it looks like a referendum is increasingly inevitable.
We get to a kind of referendum if we get there eventually. Uh-huh. And I'm kind of the view that it might not come immediately, but there is an inevitability of we might get there in the end, because I can't see an easy way out for anyone else.
I think David Runciman's position that you outlined earlier from that article on the weekend, I mean, it is the right position, because at the end of the day, how do you legislate for a referendum that the executive doesn't support.
Yeah.
So either you had to overthrow the government and have a majority in parliament for a national unity government that was going to carry through a referendum, or the Tories had to say, you know what, let's go for a referendum. And the politics of the latter just look impossible in terms of their support.
But then I think we shouldn't be too hard on ourselves, because you've got to remember that even the kind of ultimately pretty Brexity figures, before the referendum happened, people like David Davis were saying, well, what we should do is have a referendum, get the deal, have a second referendum.
I've got the quote here. He used to advocate a double referendum strategy, and I quote now, you didn't like the last time I quoted you, we also commit the country to a decision referendum
this one.
To be held when the EU negotiation is concluded. And then you said something rather wise. You said, if a democracy cannot change its mind, it ceases to be a democracy. And the question is, as ever, who decides? All Let's right. say we have a deal. Who decides? Is it Theresa May on her own in number 10? Is it a bunch of politicians in Westminster? Or is it you? And I believe it should be you.
It was quite a reasonable position to take before it happened. The kind of polarisation, which I still think is quite asymmetric, happened since the vote.
I think that, for me, it was difficult to ever imagine a second referendum without the government having fallen, and probably that would have happened through an election, but not necessarily, I accept. But for me, that points to a much wider point, and I think I saw Tom Walker, one of who I think has been on this show before, talked about this on Twitter the other day. The Remain project and the Corbyn project are intimately linked together. One could not have succeeded without the other. Yet there was a fundamental misunderstanding of that on both sides.
Yeah,
outside of the great work that Another Europe Is Possible did, like actually we were one of the only groups that were constantly and consistently saying this. And all of the Remainers who decided they despised Corbyn, and all the Corbynites who absolutely hated Remainers, absolutely missed the point. There was no way for those two projects to succeed without each other. And the idea that Corbyn could have taken a different line on Brexit and won an election is a nonsense to me, because the Labour Party that he's leading is a fundamentally Remain party. That's where people were. It would have been impossible to get any other position really through in the end. And that just needed to be accepted from the beginning. At the same time, the Remainers needed to accept that whatever they thought of Jeremy Corbyn,
outside of a
Labour Party government, it's very, very difficult to imagine how we would ever have remained in the European Union.
That's how all of us kind of got together in the first place, was at the end of 2017. I remember the meeting where we said, you know, are we an organiser? Are we a load of people working outside Parliament towards this aim? Are we working within Parliament? Are we trying to draw together strands of different parties? And it was just completely obvious. There was nothing to be done apart from to move the Labour Party. And then, so it was at the end of 2017 that, you know, Eloise started working with you guys. That was the end of 2017, and we wasted 6 to 8 months thinking we could move the Labour Party by talking to them. And actually only Michael Chesham understood there was no talking to them. You had to bring the motions to conference or shut up. There was no point getting into a room with John McDonnell. There was no point, even if you could, getting into a room with Jeremy Corbyn, because they only ever spoke to you when you were causing them a problem.
At 2018 Labour conference, Keir Starmer, bless him, gives the speech that everyone remembers as the massive Remainer speech.
Our options must include campaigning for a public vote, and nobody is ruling out Remain as an option.
He has these what now seems to me like just the absurd sequential line, and he's really passionate about it, and the whole Labour conference is really behind it. Our priority is a general election.
Our preference is clear. We want a general election to sweep away this failed government. And conference. Having swept them away, we want to install a radical Labour government capable of transforming this country. And that's what should happen after 2 years of negotiations ending in failure.
I'm just observing it was an absurd line to take, for the Labour Party to take. Because I think what's really clear about the messaging that the Tories have used, it's totally clear that what you understood what Johnson's position was in the general election, and you understood the logic. You can't get this through Parliament. Parliament's distracted by other issues. I want to unleash Britain's potential. Give me a big majority. There's chaos in Parliament. It's true, there is. And these are my priorities. Now, what ordinary member of the public would possibly think this strange, well, our priority is a general election, but yes, we'll go for a referendum, and yes, we'll go for Remain, is a policy position about what you should do on the central question in British politics. It isn't. I mean, and they did have other options. They could have just come in saying we're completely ruling out a referendum, but we support membership of the single market. Or they could come in and say, we think we're going to, Remain is still the best option. There's chaos in Parliament and we're going to campaign for Remain, and we'll campaign for it in a referendum and we'll campaign for it in a general election. But, you know, they had clear positions that they could take, but thinking that that sort of strange temporal stagist argument made sense to the general public, I think, is the real big failing of the Labour leadership.
And it's a failing of ours as well, because it's like, from our point of view, it took such a lot to get them to that point. We were all like, yay, he said it.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, it took such a lot to get those composite motion through. It took such a lot to get that composite motion honestly reflected in the conference speech and on the conference hall. There was Len McCluskey came out and denied it 2 hours later, if you remember. You know, it took such a lot that, yeah, you're completely right, it made perfect sense to us why we were celebrating, but it probably didn't make a lot of sense to the rest of the country.
No.
And well, everything was just so difficult. Every movement, every tiny little movement took such a vast amount of energy. Mm. And, unfortunately, I think that sapped people's energy for doing other things as well. And clearly, the whole process made, you know, many Remainers frankly despair with some of what the Labour leadership were coming out with, and unfortunately that was damage that couldn't really be undone at a later date. It had happened, and it was such a massive difference therefore 2017 to 2019, because none of that had happened.
Well, it goes back to what you said about Corbyn and Remain being indivisible. The problem is that the values were indivisible. So all the people who believed passionately for Remain, part of what we believed in, let's be honest, was against what Brexit stood for, not necessarily for what Remain stood for. It was against the shock doctrine. It was against the racism. It was against the hedge fund capering. It was against people like Jacob Rees-Mogg. That's part of what the values were. And those are also the values of the Labour Party. Once you split those people, you can't win anything. How could we possibly have won an election like that? You know, I was lukewarm by the end of it. And there's one more regret. This is probably not the last thing I'm ever going to say, but this is my last regret in this phase, is that I remember having a meeting with Francis O'Grady. Actually, this is probably a bit before this, probably 2017. And her saying about Unite, they've bet the farm on it being Corbyn or Remain, on the country having a choice. You can have one of those delicious Christmas presents or the other. And that's the calculation, and he won't be budged. And I just didn't take it seriously, because this is like something to reflect on forever, is when I hear something I think is stupid, I don't take it seriously as a thing that somebody else believes. And I still think that's stupid, but in the future, I'd go in and think, if that person really believes that, however stupid it is, there it is, that's what they think.
Yeah, I... Well, that's for you to ponder. I was going to say that... I'm always... I'm in two minds on it, because I look at that confusion of the Labour position, and I do think, especially going through the videos and going through the archive, it could have been different if they had adjusted their line, including in the famous, infamous red wall to blue wall seats. I think so much of Corbyn's loss of reputation and standing was the refusal to make a position. On the other hand, I do would say that I don't think we, in the Another Europe side, probably took seriously enough how strongly felt like the idea of implementing the referendum was to in a lot of those places, Leave voting, Labour voting, Britain.
But even still, you know, people say that, and obviously they do feel really strongly because a lot of people did vote Tory and didn't enjoy voting Tory, and a lot of those seats, you know, like Birmingham, Northfields, people, I mean, I remember I went to do some canvassing in 2019 up there, and they didn't want to vote for anybody, but there was quite a strong sense of civic duty that you had to vote for somebody, but they were obviously kind of not even shy Tories, just depressed, reluctant Tories because they couldn't vote Labour. But I don't see it. I think the problem is that nobody kind of shook that to its rafters, that notion that it was a kind of democratic moment and it had to be enacted because it was democracy.
I was with my family the day after the election and there were several floating voters there, some of whom had indeed voted Tory, and I was very surprised because almost all of them had voted Remain, and I was trying to get to the bottom of it, and of course there was all of the stuff around Corbyn's personality and so on that came up quite centrally, but there was definitely a clear feeling, we've had enough of this, let's just get on with it. They've started it now, you might as well let them get on with it, which does suggest to me that the problem was a lack of clarity rather than anything else, because if Labour had come out with something very, very clear which people had understood. I mean, don't you remember those vox pops where people went up to so-called red wall constituencies and people were saying, look, the problem is I just don't know what he thinks. And I'd rather disagree with him and him come out and say it and stand by it than this kind of, you know, triangulation, whatever word you'd use for triangulation, fence sitting, you know. And there were people saying, I didn't agree with Tony Blair, but at least you knew where he stood on things. And I really do think that was a problem when it came down to it. Johnson's message was so clear, even though it was built on a lie, and Labour, in trying to please the whole breadth of their constituency, had actually come up with a position that people found difficult to even understand, never mind feel passionately or strongly about. And so people were like, let's just do this and see what happens. And it's also why I think there's some hope in the current moment, because that can change very quickly.
That can change
very, very quickly. People can say, I was sold a lie on this. You promised it would be over. It's clearly not over. Or to the extent it is over, you know, if he actually goes for the no deal, so-called Australia option. Now, the utter damage that will be inflicted as a result of that. I don't think people who voted for it will feel particularly implicated in that decision or particularly defend them through it.
And that's actually the weird thing about lying in politics, is that we thought that it was a disqualification. It's transpired that it's not a disqualification. But what it does disqualify is mandate, because whatever your mandate was, it evaporates as soon as people say, well, were you lied about that? So even though people seem to have a very high tolerance for a known liar in the highest public office, I don't think it will. He's not going to be able to say we're all in this together when it all goes tits up.
There's a big psychological difference, though, in the sense that it's the referendum question. And I think that that's, like, people voted for it, so they felt that they had directly, so they felt that they had a stake in it in a way that they didn't. And that was the thing that we couldn't get over, I think, structurally in the situation, is that we were always promising another referendum that people didn't want, and we couldn't get around that. And when the Liberal Democrats tried to, in a completely performatively useless way, get around that, they got pilloried for it with some justification, because you're cancelling a democratic vote without a second vote. I think that sort of exhaustion.
I know, there is something a bit Lord of the Rings about it all, isn't there? This kind of only a democratic vote can cancel a democratic vote, but the vote has to be made of gold, and this is made of fake gold. It's kind of both logically and emotionally, it's difficult to see how you get out of this terrible idea once you're in it.
But there was something to be said for the Labour position if you understood it, which was actually what they were going to do was put on basically a single market option, so a compromise between Leavers and Remainers against Remain.
The one thing that's cheering me up now is thinking, actually, if you look at the way they were between 2017 and 2019, if you look at the way they were in the run-up to the election, and if you look about the exact manner in which they lost the election, I don't think we would have won the referendum.
That is something I've considered as well. I mean, that's genuinely something I've considered.
Yeah, and then we would have been fighting for this, and we would have got what we wanted, and then we would have lost again.
Yeah, I think that's quite possible. Because look, they're, in the end, although there's churn in the data, so, you know, the Leavers that change their minds are cancelled out by the Remainers that think that they would now vote for Brexit because you have to accept the referendum, and then there's a bit of demographic change that helps us. But I don't think that slither of democratic change that gives Remainers the majority in most of the opinion polls would survive a campaign. I think that they would probably win, would have won a second time. And that sort of brings us to the 2019 European elections, because this does look like the moment that I feel, at least, that we lost.
The Brexit Party, 915,686.
A new party, but a familiar face. Nigel Farage jubilant as his Brexit party bagged 29 seats in the European elections.
And even if you take into account, you know, less people vote in the European elections and stuff, clearly the success that Farage and the Brexit party had in that moment indicated a kind of rise of right-wing populism that was very strongly in favour of Brexit in the country that was difficult for us to get around. And then on the other hand, on the Labour side, for all of our campaigning efforts, the thing that brought them round to a second referendum position wasn't in the end our campaigning efforts, it was electoral defeat, so their voters going elsewhere to the Liberal Democrats and Greens in the European elections and tanking in the polls. So it was the voters that in both directions acted to create the situation and not the campaigners.
Well, I think it's a bit of everything, isn't it? It's a bit of everything, and I think most campaign victories or campaign defeats probably are a bit of everything. So, but certainly that was a wake-up call. And it was a wake-up call, I think, that showed the country was still deeply, deeply divided on this issue. And the problem for us on the left or the progressive side of the spectrum was we were more divided than the right of the spectrum, and at that point Labour recognised that was going to be a complete electoral nightmare under our electoral system.
But also, I mean, the problem, I mean, I think it was the European elections that I lost hope, actually, because it wasn't actually the rise of the Brexit party, because people are always casting stupid votes in European elections because nobody ever takes them seriously. So they go, oh, look, this is a funny man. Oh, I like the colour turquoise. So I didn't get a kind of a sense of a huge surge of the far right sentiment or racist sentiment, or no, certainly no more than had been there since June the 24th, 2016. What really bugged me or worried me or freaked me out or depressed me or any of those things was the behaviour of the Labour Party in that election. Because they'd actually, Corbyn, of course, had already signed up to the Parliament of European Socialists manifesto, which is one of the most beautiful documents I've ever read. You know, it's really, really bold, really hopeful, really joined up, really thoughtful. And he'd signed it off. You know, he was in the meeting where they wrote it. He nodded it through, and none of it made it through to their campaign literature. They didn't have any interest in it. They didn't have any interest in the promises it made. They didn't have any interest in the cooperation embedded in it. They just didn't have any interest in it.
But they almost made a decision, didn't they, not to campaign in that election because they didn't want to look like they were Remainers and that they were going to be staying in the European Union. Yeah. And that was... I think the problem with that moment was, although it was a bit of a wake-up call to them when the result came in, I think it left a lot of their campaigners and activists deeply, deeply depressed about the state of things.
Exactly.
And the results of that came to show in the general election itself. But it was a very depressing moment.
But in terms of us and our response personally and organisationally, I'm not sure what I would do differently if I had that election again.
The European election?
Yeah.
No.
I mean, I could say maybe I'd have prophylactically gone on antidepressants before it. But that's probably the only thing I would do differently, because I believed in that. I believed in the PES manifesto, and I believed that if we'd won, it would have meant something.
Yeah, because I think one of the ironies of the Labour attempt to appeal to Leave voters is that it was using all of this deeply technical, weird language that no Leave voter would engage with anyway, and was almost just designed to sound as opportunist as possible. We're only interested in power. We're not interested in anything else. I guess looking back, what I would say is that, I mean, they're on the other side of the debate, but I think the much more thoughtful criticisms does come from people like Cruddas and Lisa Nandy, who were talking in language that would genuinely engage Leave voters. So if they were at the time running the Labour Party, I think the Labour Party would have been much more effective at keeping hold some of its Leave voters.
Yeah, but it would have lost its Remain
voters. That's the problem.
That's the scissors crisis.
I mean, I wouldn't have voted for a party led by Cruddas or Nandy.
I mean, you see, and in that sense, the European election didn't affect me quite as badly because, after all, a lot of those Labour MEPs were replaced by Green MEPs.
Yeah,
right.
And the Green
surge was phenomenal and actually proved, I think, that you could have significant electoral success on an explicitly Remain platform linked to fundamental and radical social change.
I know, but that's brought us, that did catapult us towards the landslide Tory victory that has now rendered all those MEPs
and I think that's where Nandy and Cruddas are right in what they were saying for a long time.
But there's two
souls of English socialism, if you like. There's a working class, I don't think they would use the word nativist, but, you know, socially conservative, small town, working class soul of English labourism. And there's a kind of cosmopolitan, metropolitan English progressive vote, which is sometimes Labour, but can also go to other parties. That's probably much more fluid in its electoral alignments. And I think in terms of their analysis, the election bears that out quite well.
You see, I don't agree with you. I think the only element in which that small town, you know, nativist Labour vote was naturally anti-EU was the sense in which they really enjoyed poking Westminster in the eye. So it wasn't like there's been a massive anti-EU feeling in the Labour movement in that red wall for years, and they've been sitting in their Wigan CLP meetings saying, oh, we've got to get out of the EU in the way that the Brexit Party had and the Tories had. There wasn't a high salience issue for them, and I think they would have...
It became
a proxy war for the fact that the kind of metropolitan side of the party and that Wigan side of the party were perceived to have and also had peeled apart over the years. So it became a proxy war for that. But I think if we'd been able to shift that proxy war into something else or have that proxy war honestly in terms of kind of having a real conversation about how the metropolitan elite could reconnect with the red wall, then that would have shunted the EU way off the agenda because nobody really cared about it.
Oh, I agree with that conclusion. I don't think the way to... it's about shunting it off the agenda rather than giving up your politics.
I think you've got to be a bit careful on this. I think these tendencies are a lot more long-term. And for me, when you start talking about some of the communities you're talking about that were put off Labour because of their... I don't think they were put off Labour because of their pro-EU position. In fact, in general, I think they were miles and miles and miles from where the Labour Party was and the Labour leadership was. And that's because, as a result of many social changes and social factors, those people have become more right-wing. It's not that they're socialists who wanted to leave the EU. Their views and principles and values are at this point very conservative. Now the hope I've got is that the biggest division over the EU and in the last election was not in some ways was not the division of different classes or different parts of the country, although of course that is there. But the biggest division is a generational division, and it is a division between conservative and progressive views and values. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that kind of time is on our side, if you like. Demographics are on our side if we can get there in time, and the world doesn't burn before we actually before we achieve any of this. But I don't think there was a shortcut through a specific EU position to reaching out to people who, frankly, have moved a very, very long way from progressive Labour values.
Well, that is a brilliant point. And if you're right, and I think you are, then a lot of my regrets kind of disappear.
Well, I don't see what else we could have done degree.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, this debate had become a debate about progressive values in our society or left-wing values in our society.
Unless
we're just going to get rid of those values, I don't think that simply saying, OK, let's leave the EU would have sorted out the problem.
Your note of optimism, I'm not sure, is quite right, though, because while long-term demographic change, very long-term, is just about in our favour, unfortunately, because of the flood of young people to the cities for jobs, there are more places that are looking like the fallen red wall seats.
Yeah, but actually,
and Johnson, rather than less, at the next general election. And Johnson actually doesn't have, for all his talk about revolutionising the North and levelling up and all the language infrastructure revolution that he used in the campaign, he actually has a political interest in ensuring places like Mansfield and Blythe Valley stay as much as they are like now as possible. You don't want loads of investment that brings graduates and skilled work into the town and new public sector workers, because they'll tend to vote Labour. You don't want loads of young people moving in. You want as many of the greying older population with socially conservative views who are holding up the conservative vote.
I'm not at all. I mean, you're absolutely right in that analysis, but I'm not at all as negative or pessimistic as you are about the ability of a different Labour leader to appeal to people, even if they have got moderately socially conservative views. That, you know, everybody is biconceptual, everybody can be met, everybody responds to different arguments if those arguments are made in certain ways. I think you can, you know, people talked a lot about that red wall, the people who are canvassing in the seats around Manchester that were incredibly, you know, who went wholesale Tory. They said, you know, they were responding, they didn't like the kind of people who spoke to them about climate change, but they responded really well to the kind of masculinist identities around the Green New Deal, because it was kind of that kind of sense of high-skilled work and your work being your identity and having meaning and there being solidarity in that. People really responded to it, even if they were bloody years out of the workforce and were never going to work another day in their lives. So I think there are certainly things a Labour government, a reimagined Labour government or opposition could say to those people, which wouldn't involve pretending to be homophobic in the North and LGBTQ plus in the South. I think everybody can be spoken to in an honest way with the same message. But, you know, a lot of their problems with Corbyn, I completely agreed with. The only difference between me and an Altrincham Sale Tory voter was that they didn't hate Boris Johnson as much as I did. But when they said to me, Jeremy, you don't know who Jeremy Corbyn, what he believes anymore, you don't know who's pulling the strings, you don't know why he says what he says, you don't know what he's going to say tomorrow, you don't believe that he's got any leadership, you don't feel like he's listening, I agreed with that entirely.
But it's a bit. It is sad, though, that actually some of the policies in the manifesto, and in the manifesto, to my mind, was great. It probably was too full, and there was too much thrown at the election. We've had all that discussion in the media and so on. But that actually some of the policies in there were extremely popular.
If they could just have got them over in the right way. I think the Green New Deal was. I mean, it was as close as anything I've seen to an idea that can unite the entire country.
Right, we're out of time, I think. Let me say goodbye. Thanks for coming on, Nick.
It's a pleasure.
Looking forward to see you again soon. So that concludes the podcast. There's no extra time this week because we've talked for so long and it's a 4-year timeline and it occupied our attention. But if you are willing to support the campaign, we would encourage you to go to anothereurope.org/join. Members of the Another Europe is Possible campaign usually get access to extra material on the podcast as a benefit of membership. We're not going anywhere. We've got loads of campaigning to do. We're going to fight the Trumpian trade deal alongside Global Justice Now and fight for a closer relationship with Europe. So please support us. Join the campaign. We'll be back very soon. See you then.